Welcome back. It's another Red Star Radio interview, and today I'm very pleased to be joined by Carlos Garrido. He is one of the founders and he is the editor of Midwestern Marks, and he's here today to talk about a recent book he's brought out called Marxism and the Dialectical Materialist Worldview, which is an anthology of classical Marxist texts on dialectical materialism, to which he has written a very useful and thought-provoking introduction. Carlos, welcome to Red Star Radio.
Thank you. It's truly a pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to start off by discussing the book and your introduction to it, because in the in your text for the introduction, you put forward the point of view that Marxism really needs to be understood as a cohesive worldview, which is not a point of view which is common, certainly not amongst the British Marxist groups, which I've been familiar with and the one I was previously a member of. So when you were writing the introduction, when you were developing this this point of view yourself, were you thinking then that the way in which Western Marxism had developed was fragmented and had become divided by like the New Left tradition or the postmodern influence on it?
Well, yes, absolutely. There's in the U.S., but I guess in the West in general, there has been a lot of institutional backing, financing, and proliferation of distortions of Marxism from the beginning, I guess, of the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And one of the things that has happened is that the Marxism that has came to dominate the West, and I would say primarily before the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Marxism that has came to dominate the West outside of parties, outside of communist parties, has primarily been one which is very skeptical of any grand narrative, especially after the 70s and 80s. It's pretty much inherited the spirit of postmodernism, and it's allowed a lot of foreign elements to come into it. Even before the development of postmodernism, one of the things that you have with the Frankfurt School and that initial tradition in Western Marxism that turns away from Marxism-Leninism and from the gains that were being made by the Bolshevik Revolution, one of the things that you have is a rejection of the role of Marxism in the sciences, which has been one of the areas that I've come to focus on since. And I think this is a very big mistake. They want to relegate Marxism to have only a space in human history. And what you progressively have from that development of what's known as the Engels debate, which if people want to read more about it, I would definitely recommend a book by Khan Kangal called Engels's Dialectics of Nature, which studies the legacy of the text and the debates that were brought forth in the 20s and 30s. But once you begin to reject the sphere of Marxism within the sciences and you begin to expand the amount of areas where Marxism just shouldn't comment on, you end up having the phenomenon which you have now, which is that a lot of the Marxists on the West, specifically those in the academy, although it's infiltrated at, I would say, some of the socialist organizations and parties, they don't see Marxism as a comprehensive, all-encompassing worldview that should be commenting on all sorts of things, not just on human affairs and society, but also that it can provide a helpful outlook for the sciences and that it can provide a helpful outlook for all different sorts of things. And it feels like I'm largely alone in because I'm in the academy and I'm in philosophy, it feels like I'm largely alone when I paint Marxism as a worldview. And I felt like I needed to develop in this text from the beginning a defense for why it is that that is important. And I think that if we look at the place where Marxism has been developed the most over the last few decades, and I would say it's without a doubt China, how are they treating Marxism? How are they understanding what dialectical materialism is? They understand it as a worldview, and they are constantly, especially since the Xi Jinping era, they have been constantly opening institutes to devote the analysis of different spheres of society, of different spheres of the sciences, of basically every sphere of life, to devote Marxist analysis to basically every sphere. I just recently finished reading Cheng and Fu's China's Economic Dialectic. And one of the main things that it proposes is that, like, how do we integrate Marxism into basically every discipline, because it's got important things to say in how the world is approached. That, you know, the bourgeois outlook is something that presents a fetter towards a more accurate and concrete understanding of the world, right? We have this understanding that the relations of productions present a fetter for the means of production, that there's something within the economic base of capitalism that prevents the development of human society. It's not just in economics. It's also in the realm of ideas, in the realm of the ideal, which is a category that Ilyenkov develops from Marx. And it's one of the things that I include in the anthology. Capitalism and the modes of thought and the world outlook, which permeates most of the disciplines in the capitalist world, prevents the development of the sciences. It prevents the development of culture, prevents the development of literature. And I do think that these are all areas where the dialectical materialist worldview and Marxism really would absolutely help break those fetters and help those disciplines flourish. And look, I as of very recently, you know, I've felt more and more that I'm not alone. There's different projects here in the US. There's this project called Science for the People that I had the opportunity to publish a paper in a couple months ago. And it's a group of scientists that are all Marxists and that are very embedded in the tradition of Richard Levins and Richard Lewontin, which itself is embedded in the tradition of J.D. Bernal and J.B.S. Haldane, which were both, you know, some of the leading British scientists of the 20th century, which were communists, like literally the Communist Party, and showing how much better you can approach knowing the world scientifically with the dialectical materialist worldview. And one of the things that I've tried to do through our institute and both with the book, but with like videos that are just, you know, mass media, I guess, is to show that a lot of the obscuring that takes place by the academics, that they want to sustain Marxism and the outlook and the method as something that belongs only to the sphere of academics that are publishing in order to get their CVs padded and for maybe 15 other people to read it, that's wrong. That this method, there's something almost commonsensical about it when you really begin to reflect on it. And I did a video maybe a week ago about looking at Bob Ross. I don't know if the audience is familiar with Bob Ross, but
he's a familiar figure now in Britain after the YouTube age hit us.
Right. So I started the video by joking that when I was in high school and I wasn't really a fan of learning, I would just put his videos on and watch them in class. But I got YouTube recommended one of his videos again, and I started watching it, and I was like, oh, wow, this is like, you know, it's almost a metaphor for the dialectical materialist method, which, as I describe in the text, is a method of the ascension from the abstract to the concrete. So I think that one of the things that that we should start by asking is, well, what's the abstract and what is the concrete? There's this tendency that we have today that's treats the abstract as this thing that's like far away in the mind. And particularly what the sort of archetypical image that comes to mind is one presented by Plato, which is a philosopher that's condemned as a stargazer, as the captain of a ship that's just stargazing. And the thing is that that metaphor is important because the stargazer is the one that knows how to direct the ship. but we have that idea of the abstract as this realm of thought that is really far away from the concrete. And then we think about the concrete and we just want to touch stuff. Like everything that's sensible is the concrete. And that's inversed in both Hegel and Marxism, because the concrete is treated as the unity of the diverse. And there's almost identical quotes when you look at how Hegel defines the concrete in his lectures on the history of philosophy, and then how Marx does it in his economic manuscripts from 1857 to 59, which we now know as the Grundrisse. The concrete is the unity of the diverse, or a unity of many determinations. So what's the most concrete then? Well, it's the totality. It's the whole. And what Marx does in extending on Hegel, who did that in the realm of logic, Marx does it in the realm of political economy and in Capital, is apply this dialectical materialist method, which is ascending from the abstract components, which is that which is the most disconnected from everything else, right? If I give the example usually of a boxing match, if you go to the boxing match in the 12th round, can you judge it? Most people would say, no, that would be an abstract judgment. You'd be passing judgment on a whole boxing match based on one small component that's been divorced from everything else that's been reified. It's almost been sucked out of the life of the boxing match because it's treated in a manner that's separated from the interconnections in which it exists in. So, but you have to start somewhere. And the idea of the dialectical materialist method is that you start with these abstract components and then you start putting them together and how they exist in a world in which they're by necessity interconnected to everything else, in a world in which the totality gives meaning to the parts and the parts give meaning to the whole. And this looks like an ascension from the most abstract thing to the most concrete, which is the whole. And we see that in Hegel, because Hegel starts his logical works with the category of being, which is the most abstract category you can have. And his tracing of the development of the concept goes all the way to absolute spirit, which is the whole that is conscious of itself, that is self-conscious. You see the same thing in Marx. What's the germ of capitalist political economy? It's a commodity. Hmm. That's what you start with in the first volume of Capital. And what's the last volume of Capital called? It's called Capitalist Production as a Whole, the capitalist mode of production as a whole. So, and he says it very explicitly at the beginning of the third volume of Capital. Now we have attained a level of, we have gotten to a place where what we're talking about looks a little bit more how the world actually is, because it's more concrete. And so that unfolding of categories is an unfolding from the abstract to the concrete. The categories that are presented towards the end of Capital, in order to understand them, you have to understand the ones that come before them. But the opposite is also true. In order to fully understand the ones in the beginning, you have to see them in light of what they unfold into at the end. Hmm. And so one of the things that I try to do with this, which, look, there's a school that develops out of Lomonosov University in the 60s that their whole thing is like analyzing the homology between the unfolding of the categories in Hegel and those in Marx's Capital. One of the main figures there is Ilyankov, which I include in the text. And then there's a school now in the West, it's called the New Dialectic or Systematic Dialectic, people like Chris Arthur, Tony Smith, that they're trying to do the same thing. And I read the text and it's dense stuff. If you haven't engaged with a lot of Hegel, if you don't know the history of philosophy, it's really tough to get through. And I don't think that the ideas are themselves that hard to understand, right? If you really know something, you should be able to express it in a way that even if people have to like try hard to understand it, they should be able to understand it. And The example that I gave with Bob Ross is the same thing. What you have in a painting is a process of a dialectical ascension from the abstract, the most abstract is the canvas, which is literally empty, to the concrete, and the most concrete is the finished painting. And every little piece of paint that is put on the board is interconnected to everything else, and slowly but surely you end up getting, if you keep on concretizing, you end up getting to the end of the painting, and you step back and you're like, wow, I see the whole thing. But what happens if you would have just entered the room and just seen the painting? Could you have had the same understanding of it than if you followed the whole 30 minutes in which Bob Ross does the painting? I think most people would say no. And maybe the ones that would say yes are people that are painters themselves and that can see in their minds somewhat of how the process would have looked like. But that direct engagement with the whole is something that Marx criticizes political economists for doing. And he says that what they end up engaging with is an imagined concrete. Because for Marx, just like for Hegel, the concrete is not the point of departure, but it manifests itself as the end. It is a concentration and ascension towards the concrete. And honestly, I think that if people really just sit down and think about what this means, it just makes sense. Take examples from everyday life. If you really want to understand the whole of something, you can't just go at it straight at it. You have to like decompose its parts and see how it is itself composed. And in that process, you can't separate one thing from another. You have to see them in their interconnection. The approach itself is one that entails wanting to know things and how they're related to everything else, to the whole. That's already a break from bourgeois modes of thought that don't really try to engage with the whole. They try to engage with things in a reified manner, in a way that's separated from the totalities they are embedded in and from the interconnections in which they are embedded in within those totalities. So that's just basic dialectics. Everything is in a constant process, in constant movement. That was already known by the ancient Greeks, as particularly the figure of Heraclitus, whom Hegel said in his lectures on philosophy that there was not one proposition from Heraclitus which I have not accepted in my system. Everything is in a constant state of flux. And in that state, it is in connection to everything else. And it's in connection at the same time to the whole, which shapes it as an emergent, which reciprocally then shapes it as an emergent property. And there's a lot of examples that we can provide for this. I provide two in the book, one of which is capitalist production. One of the new things that the development of industry brings about is a division of labor, not just in society at large, but within the workplace itself. And here Marx says that something emerges because production just takes off, right? When you have 12 people working for 44 hours within a factory, you produce more than if you divide them individually and each one does it on their own, then and they produce more than if it's just one individual working for 44 hours. So there's something that happens when it all comes together. And when everything's together, it almost gives more power to those individual parts that compose it, right? So it breaks completely the philosophical foundation of bourgeois individualism. That's one example. Another example is ants, right? Ants don't have the capacity when they're alone to find the food source that's the closest to the colony. But when they come together in community, there's an emergent property that arises out of the whole that cannot be pinned down to any specific part. And that emergent property allows the colony to be able to find the closest food source to the place where the colony is. That emergentism is a dialectical category that's in the sciences now, and the most leading scientists, they're using this to explain like how thought emerges, right? And these are all things that were being written on, they're being written about and used in Marx and in Engels, and in Engels quite specifically, the category of emergentism, it's there, but without the term. And he speaks about thought in ways that resemble some of the leading scientists today. So it's, I feel like I'm rambling, but I think part of the importance of this is thinking about dialectical materialism as a all-encompassing worldview, which doesn't seek to impose ideas onto the world. We don't want to foist the dialectical materialist view onto the world. And that's why I have, I'm a little worried with the word applying, because applying sort of implies that you're putting onto the world the dialectical materialist worldview. And one of the things that Marx says in a letter to Engels concerning one of the books, I think the book that Lassalle did on Heraclitus, is that he's going to find how big of a difference it is to try to foist dialectics onto the world, to apply it onto the world, than to engage with the world in such a way so that the world reveals itself to them dialectically. Mm. And so I think that that's something that's important to think about, because parts of our tradition have treated dialectics a bit mechanistically. They have treated it as just, okay, how many examples can I find of the negation of the negation of the transition of quantity to quality and vice versa, or of the unity of opposites, you know? And I want to stay away from that, but I also embrace that tradition as well, that way of formulating dialectics as an ontology, a way of thinking about the constitution and the laws that govern a world in constant interconnection and movement, an epistemology, so a way of thinking about how it is that we approach the question of knowledge, how we approach the world, what method do we use. And I call that unity of ontology and epistemology a worldview. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a worldview that if you take it with you in political praxis, your political praxis is going to be better. If you take it with you into the lab work is going to be better. Wherever you take it with you, it's going to make the activities you're doing much richer, because it's open. It sees things in movements and their interconnections. And it's what the leading Marxist theorists in the world today are formulating Marxism as. And we have to sit back and think, why is it that the place with 1.4 billion people, with hundreds of millions of leading scholars in the field of Marxism, that didn't have to, like a lot of us do, have to break through the shells of bourgeois metaphysics? Why is it that they're thinking about Marxism as a worldview and they want to bring it forth to the study of literally everything? Why is it that they're doing that? But then the Marxists in the West, who we know have been proliferated by the State Department, by capitalist foundations. I mean, read some of the books in behind me from the Frankfurt School. Just open the first flap. Look at who it is that Marcuse thanks, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation. Right? This is what the work of Gabriel Rockhill on the global theory industry shows. They funded this shit out of these people in order to have a compatible left, a sort of Marxism that is anti-communist, what Michael Parenti calls left anti-communism, and what various CIA agents have literally called just the compatible left, the one that's friendly to the State Department and the interests of capitalist imperialism. So it's a process, though. You know, I can't get mad when people want to incorporate like the Frankfurt School or something, right? Because, you know, a few years ago, I was there everything is in process, and that also includes thinking. So the process of coming to know the world through a dialectical materialist lens is itself a process, and there's a lot of layers that have to be removed of bourgeois thinking and a lot of reconstruction in thinking dialectically that has to be done.
Yeah, I mean, I suffered through multiple Frankfurt School texts in my undergraduate myself, so the pain is very real. But as you say, you have to go through it to know what's wrong with it, and right. you can't just dismiss it out of hand. So, like, I even tried to suffer through some Adorno recently, just to remind myself of like what I objected to most of all, and. You're right, which is that the anti-communism there is like incredible in terms of it's all on the surface. It's not even hidden. But also, yeah. I mean, the thing that really turned me against Marcuse especially was the ferociously anti-worker nature of it,
yes.
Which is especially one-dimensional man, which essentially I think, I mean, I'm interested in your opinion on this. I think one-dimensional man basically set the blueprint for much of the what you've called the acceptable left in the United States. It also set the blueprint for it here, which is the ever-growing distance between the organized left, the institutional Marxists, and the working class, which in my country anyway spilled over into sort of, well, not even sort of, just open contempt by the end of the 80s, and to the point now where the you would need to do a complete rebuilding on on this, because the gap between what is described as Marxism and the working class, I don't think it's ever been bigger. But what's your reflection on that from somebody who is an active communist in the United States? Has it had the same effect there, do you think?
Well, I think the comments you make are absolutely on the money, and it's really the soul for why we decided to start to create our institute a few, almost 3 years ago now. You have to ask if there is a gap, and I put it like that as well. So I'm glad to use gap. If there's a gap and an unbridgeable gap between the left and the working class, you have to ask yourself, what the hell is the class composition of the left then? Where are they coming from? If they're separated from the working class, that means that the dominant forces on the left are not the working class. They have a different culture. They have a different way of approaching problems. And what you end up finding is something that has been described by people like Barbara Ehrenreich. I think she was one of the first ones to describe it in the 70s, but it's been described by quite a few people now. Catherine Liu, that we just talked with, Vivek Shiber yesterday, and there's quite a few Marxist academics who have caught on to this, which is that the class composition dominating the socialist organizing in the U.S. is the professional managerial class. And it's not to say that you can't have professionals within the struggle for socialism. But the struggle for socialism, the base has to be the working masses. It can't be the professionals, because they bring in certain class instincts that might even be antagonistic to the struggle of the working class. And look, we in our institute, one of the things that we try to do is, I guess, combine, you know, what Gramsci called traditional and organic intellectuals. We have autodidactic workers that are union guys, but they wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to read Marxism and write, and they're just absolutely brilliant. And then you have, you know, folks that are actually within the academy. And one of the things that I get constantly And that I experienced myself is that when you go to these meetings for many of the socialist organizations, and we've had a chance to interact with all of them, we have in our institutes people from all of them. And one of the things that is common is how alienating the culture is for working people. There's some, you know, a lot of the times it's by a local basis, and there's some that are better than others, but especially in the metropolitan cities, it's very dominated by the culture of what some folks have called the iron triangle of academia, NGOs, and I forget what the other leg of the triangle is, but it's very much a PMC culture. And PMC culture, you know, our material experiences shape our ideas. And PMC culture comes from the professional managerial class, and it has a set of ideas and outlook that I think is not antagonistically contradictory to the working class, but it's definitely in a contradiction with it. if I can bring in, you know, some categories from Mao, but back to the Marcuse question, one of the interesting things that I've been noticing is the unity of Western Marxism and certain forms of contemporary Maoism. Because when you look at what both of them are doing, in One Dimensional Man and then explicitly in Soviet Marxism, one of the things that permeates those works of Marcuse and others is the idea that the working class is no longer the revolutionary agent, that they have been, especially in the North, just absorbed into capitalism, and that they benefit from capitalism. And the only revolutionary agent that's posited a little bit in One Dimensional Man, but more so in other books, is the third world. And when you look at those ideas, they're identical to contemporary Maoism, right? And not to confuse, you know, Maoism is not Mao Zedong thought, which is, you know, one of the key guiding ideologies of the CPC, which I you know, that's good. Maoism, it's a whole nother monster. It's but the when you look at it, it stems from a distortion, a very bad distortion of Lenin's reading of the labor aristocracy.
Yeah.
Right. The concept of the labor aristocracy stems from Lenin trying to understand the objective conditions behind part of the socialist movement and the labor movement in Europe supporting the war. And the labor aristocracy holds that a very small segment of the organized labor movement, those at the top, they get the ones at the bottom, the regular rank and file folks, to support war because they themselves are benefiting from it. They get basically crumbs off the plate of what the imperialist bourgeoisie is able to super exploit from the third world. And the idea is that communists should join those mass unions, and they should point that out to the workers. Like, hey, those guys leading the union are part of this labor aristocracy that is selling out the working class to the capitalist class. That's the idea of the labor aristocracy. It's not a full-fledged condemnation of the workers in Europe or the working class of the North or in the US. It's an acknowledgement that the leading figures can be bought off, and that you should fight against that, right? That social chauvinism and right opportunism takes place in those leading areas. And what these people do, like Marcuse and the Maoists and other parts of the Frankfurt School, or people today like Alain Badiou, what they do is say, no, the labor aristocracy is the whole North. It's every working class person in Europe, every working class person in the US. And that's absolutely bullshit. It was bullshit when they wrote about it, and it's even more bullshit today after 40 years of neoliberalism that has just brought austerity, privatization, the destruction of unions. It's made the living conditions of working people really, really, really awful. And in the US, to speak about the labor aristocracy in this way is just completely absurd. It almost resembles some of the central thesis of trickle-down economics. And this is a point that, you know, one of our institute editors and researchers, Noah Krashevich, he made that, and people got mad at him, but it's true, right? It resembles the points of trickle-down economics. What the bourgeoisie makes, it trickles down to the working class, and therefore the working class benefits from imperialism. And it's bullshit. It's absolute bullshit. And you can't sit here in 2022 and tell me while there's 70,000 people dying in the US because they don't have adequate health insurance, while 60% of Americans are paycheck away from homelessness, while you have, 30% of Americans suffering with depression and anxiety because their lives in the system is unbearable. When you look at just the plethora of statistics you can pull, which I consider to be symptomatic of objectively revolutionary conditions, to sit there and tell me that the US working class benefits from imperialism is just criminal. It's absolutely criminal, and it depicts these forms of compatible Marxism, which they're not just like neutral to the existing order. They are an indispensable component of it. The ruling class knows that every 8 or so years, the system crashes, and that around that time, the mass of working people end up developing dissenting ideas, and they end up recognizing, even more than in times of normalcy, in times of growth, that something is fucked up. And if there are revolutionary organizations there that can get them organized, that can give them the right ideas, that can help them understand the systematic character of their personal experiences, you have a revolutionary situation. So what do you need? You need a controlled form of counter-hegemony, a place that's backed by institutions, that's financially backed by the most powerful interests in the US, that people can go to when they have dissenting attitudes, and they go there because of the amount of funding that they have, but they're actually controlled. They allow them to go there because it is a controlled form of opposition, a controlled counter-hegemony that actually serves the interests of the current hegemonic order. And that's why I think a lot of the things that we are fighting against today is those distortions of Marxism, which are used to channel the energy that people have been developing because of how messed up their objective conditions are, to channel that energy into spaces that don't substantially oppose capitalist imperialism. And that's part of the fight that our institute is waging today.
Well, I think we've had now 14 years since the great crash of 2008. And what we've had, and certainly in the British case, certainly in the American case as well, and I feel I would argue France comes into this as well, is a series of false starts in terms of actual building of any kind of advance in working class consciousness. We've had the diversion of reformism coming back again in its social democratic form in Britain. I'd argue in France as well, slightly with Mélenchon, and certainly in the case of the United States with the Sanders thing. And that rapidly just hits a dead end, because not only is it the case that the working class isn't actually strong enough yet to force capital into being able to provide some kind of reform, but capital can't provide a reform at this stage because the system's so rotten. There's not much give in British capitalism anymore, and hasn't been for quite some time. So the social democracy that Jeremy Corbyn wanted to actually present to people, I would argue, is no longer possible or desirable, in fact. But my point is that exactly what you're saying is correct here, which is because there was a complete absence of the subjective factor in Britain, which is the presence of a revolutionary party with clear links to and organic links into the masses. Therefore, what we got was the false start of Corbyn. We got the false populism of Brexit. I think broadly analogous with your situation would be the false populism of Trump. And then you end up back to square one again with millions of people demoralized and more atomized than ever. And without the development of a proper communist party, then we're going to keep on this merry-go-round, I think. What's your take on that?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head again. I would say that today, utopianism is not found in those who think that we need to fully sublate the existing order, that we need a radical qualitative change in our economic system, in our political structure, in our institutions and civil society. Utopianism is not in those people. Real utopianism is in those who think that we can accomplish anything through reformism. And I say this with an ism in the back, right? Because I think the struggle for reforms is an integral part of a revolutionary struggle, in part because, especially in moments like the ones that we're in, we know that reforms are not going to work, and they help they help us in pointing to working people. For instance, with the Bernie movement, right? Look at the small reforms that Bernie was trying to do, right? If the bourgeoisie here was smart, if they were smart and not just absolute idiots, they would realize that Bernie Sanders was like the best thing that could have happened to them. But anyways, that's another case. But you look at the failures in the limits of social democracy and the reformist strategy, and you get working people to see them. And that's how you, I think, today develop a revolutionary movement. In part, we have to be involved in those mass politics that are asking for specific reforms. And I can guarantee, at least in the U.S., they're not going to be given. We know the Democratic Party doesn't want to give them. The Republican Party is not going to give them. And, you know, movements have developed, as you mentioned, and they have been very ephemeral. They have served as almost a libidinal release for people who are discontent with their life. They go out, they scream a few chants, they put up a few signs, they walk a few blocks, they take some pictures, and then they go back to work on Monday. And that has been the movementism of the last two decades or so. And it's because there's no revolutionary party that can organize these people with revolutionary consciousness that's aware of the systematic character of the issues and that can look at them in an integrative manner and see that, oh, it's not just this here. It's also connected to this, and it's also connected to this. And it's, if you look at it as a whole, it's the whole system that has to be overthrown. And so I think that today, especially like take U.S. healthcare, there's billions and billions and billions of dollars being made through healthcare, right? Some of the largest monopolies are in healthcare. Do you really think that you can get through Bernie Sanders type of reform, something like a universal health system here, or even a single payer? Of course not. And that's a reform. But, you know, capitalism has concentrated to a point where reforms have become, I think, more unthinkable than just overthrowing the whole thing. And I think that today the real utopians are the ones that think that you can have, like you did in the middle of the last century, these reform bits that you can just give to the working class. You know, the finance capital has developed to such an extreme that I don't think that can happen anymore. I do think that, you know, wherever people are in movement, we should be there and bringing up the property question. So, you know, the two founders of our institute, myself and Eddie, we came out of the Bernie movement, and through the limitations of the Bernie movement and through our, you know, reading of Marxism and stuff, we came to Marxism-Leninism and to communist politics. And I think that there, it could work as a pipeline for a lot of people to see the limitations in this social democratic reformist, politics. So I don't want to condemn it to the point of, I don't think people should show up. I think communists should show up and guide those people into a real movement that can get not only the reforms that they want, but a hell of a lot more. So it's, I do think that at the end of the day, we have, I know in the US specifically, that's what I've studied the most. We have every single marker that Lenin lays out for what objective conditions are. We have those. We have people's lives being miserable. We have people wanting to hit the streets en masse. You know, we had for however bought into the Democratic Party the BLM movement was, it was 30 million people in the U.S. in the streets. That has never been seen before. So people want to hit the streets, and we participated in those places, and people wanted genuine change, but there was no one there to tell them. There was no one there to tell them that there can be an alternative. And what you have to do to have that alternative is just create a communist party that wins the working class and grabs power. And there was no one there to tell them, because the groups that the organizations that have the institutional tools to do that, they were just tailing those movements. And you can't be a vanguard organization, which means you're the most advanced detachment of the working class, if you're behind the working class. The point is not to go down to the spontaneous consciousness of the working masses and stay there. It's to use the radical kernels in that spontaneous common sense consciousness to elevate those and rearticulate them towards socialism, to elevate their consciousness. And that's not being done. And I think in a large part, it's a mixture of both the objective conditions that dominate what socialist organizations look like. Again, a lot of PMC culture, a lot of institutionalized support for these pseudo-Marxisms that make socialist organizations feel like HR meetings. And then connected to that is a lack of theory, a lack of education, a lack of the dialectical materialist outlook. And that manifests itself ideologically in what I've been developing as the purity fetish, right? Mm. The marker for being able to support a movement or a country that's fighting against imperialism, the marker for being able to fight for socialism with a specific part of the working class is purity. Right. There's this static idea of what socialism should look like, what the working class should look like in our context in the US, what the US is. There's this static and one-sided idea. And if things don't align with that one-sided pure idea, you reject it. And so you have the mass politics that's taking place in the democratic socialist movement. It falls right into right opportunism, supporting the State Department line, basically on every single socialist country around the globe. And even more, perhaps on those countries that exist outside of the sphere of imperialism that are not socialist, but that because geopolitically, the role that they're playing is anti-imperialist, they're playing historically a progressive role. You reject them if they don't measure up to your standard of purity. You reject large swaths of the working class. Look, Trump ignited a movement that I'm not going to sit here and say it was all working class, but it has a significant portion that was working class, around 30% or so. And it was in large part the working class that was in the former Rust Belt, where the industry that's the ground of basically any capitalist economy is. And there's a big portion of socialists and communists in the US who, when they think of a Trump supporter, they just think of a fascist. And they treat it in the words of Comrade Hillary Clinton as a basket, a basket of deplorables. And it's insane because it means that before I can approach a working class person with a message of socialism, they have to already agree with socialism, which puts into question what the hell the purpose of a party is. If you can't bring people to agree with your ideas who are in a class position that their instinct is to agree with your ideas, if you can't bring them out of the Trump movement to accept socialism, why the hell are you a socialist? Why are you a communist? If you can't bring anyone into the communist movement, if the only people you talk to are the people that are already enlightened enough that agree and scratch off all of your purity markers as if it was a goddamn shopping list, it's absurd. And, you know, I see it manifested itself in who is supported abroad, what countries are supported. I see it manifesting itself in the US and what parts of the working class are okay to organize with. You know, it's almost as if the slogan, you know, from the Comintern is no longer, for these people, workers and oppressed people of the world unite. It's enlightened workers and oppressed people of the world unite. And it's absurd. And there's also, connected to the right opportunism and the ultra leftism, which I think are two forms through which this purity fetish manifests itself. There's also how the history of the US is read. And I'm sure something similar can perhaps happens over there in Britain. The history of the US is read by these people as just the history of genocide, of empire, of conquest and exploitation, racism, slavery. It's just the worst part of the history. And they can't separate, you know, the history of the ruling class, the history of capitalism, the history of the state. They can't separate that from the history of working people and the labor movement and progressive movements and the socialist movement. And so they end up treating US history very synecdochally. They just take an abstract part and they treat it as if it's the whole. And that form of abstract thinking is horrific. And that's a manifestation of the purity fetish. The history of America is not pure. And therefore, socialism has to be formulated as abolish America. And I don't know if this sounds ridiculous to you guys, but over here is ridiculous as hell, because that's precisely what McCarthyism wanted people to think communism was. They wanted people to think that communism is completely anti-America, that the American people are on one side and communism and socialism are on the other. And there's an unbridgeable gap between the two. And what's insane is that that ideological weapon that was used by the state, that was used by anti-communist McCarthyism, is now incorporated as a central component in how it is that communists think about the history of the US. And no working class person is going to join a communist or socialist movement if they're phrasing socialism as the abolition of America. I'm sorry. No one is going to do that. No. And in the history of the US communist movement, the socialist movement, the progressive movement, there's so much to look back at and be so extremely proud. We had, I don't know if it took place over there as well, but we had in the U.S. this debate about patriotism. And to be fair, there were parts of the, you know, the pro-patriotic socialism, there was parts of it that, you know, they really were just flirting with conservatism, and it wasn't in the sense that I think a more complex outlook would see things. But for us, you know, the issue of patriotism was the issue of, can you have pride in the history of struggle in your country?
Hmm.
And as a project, which one of their main angles is studying the history of struggle, the history of communist struggles, socialist struggles, labor struggles, struggles against slavery and against racism, sexism, you know, as a project that's focused on that, hell yeah, we can have pride in that history. Why do we think the ruling class in their history textbooks erase it? Why do we think they sanitize it? Why do we think they domesticate it? What we the only person in the U.S. who has a holiday after them is Martin Luther King Jr., who was a socialist. After the civil rights movement, the first phase, the second phase is all about class struggle. It's about condemning militarism, condemning war, condemning poverty, condemning capitalism. And he, you know, he had certain anti-communist elements. And of course, those are the parts we want to leave out. But he was very much a socialist. And that radical king, as some have called it, that's not the one we celebrate every I believe it's February whenever the third Monday of every January. That's not the one we celebrate. And why not? It's because they don't want the working masses of the U.S. to realize that they have a beautiful past of struggle. And it is our job to bring that back, to have that past serve as the historical legs for our movement today. And the communists in the U.S. are not doing that. They are accepting the narrative that America can be reduced to empire, slavery, genocide, et cetera, and that it should be abolished as a whole. And it breaks completely with the tradition of communism, which has seen itself as taking, you know, the universal bourgeois ideals that were obviously never lived up to because of the existing order, the capitalist mode of life, but the ideals of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, right to revolution, and government of, by, and for the people. I'm sorry to say this, but all of those conditions can only be met under socialism. And the history of the socialist struggle has realized that the practical and logical conclusion, if we are faithful to those ideals, is socialism. I mean, Fidel cites it in History Will Absolve Me. Ho Chi Minh cites it in the Declaration of Independence. Why are American communists condemning it when their whole history has been showing working people that if they really want to live up to that spirit, they need to embrace socialism? And it's just completely absurd. There's so, you know, one of the things that I've been looking at in my personal research for the last 2 years has been the development of the non-utopian form of socialism at the beginning of the 19th century. You know, we know there was a lot of utopian communist communities in the U.S. in the 19th century. Engels obviously wrote a lot about this. Part of utopian socialism, utopian and scientific, is looking at thinkers, Charles Fourier, Robert Owens, seeing some thinkers whose ideas shaped a lot of these communities that 90-something% of them were in the U.S. But there's another tendency that flirted with utopianism and then said, this isn't it. You know, this harmonizing of classes, this escapism of the existing order, this isn't it. There was a tendency that develops, and I've written about this, and I am studying and writing about this. There's a tendency that develops in the 20s and 30s, 1820s, 1830s, one or two decades before Marx and Engels ever write anything of major substance, that says we have to analyze the existing system systematically. We have to study it scientifically. And once we do that, we would see that the keys are already within it for a new world. And what is that, if not scientific socialism? Scientific socialism tells you that if you study the existing order, the capitalist mode of life scientifically, out of its own contradictions, the possibility for socialism is there. You don't go around capitalism, you go fucking through it. You go through it. And that's what you get if you study it systematically. And these people in the 1820s, people like William McClure, Langdon Bilsby, Thomas Skidmore, there's like 12 of them that wrote books trying to figure out the system, trying to study it scientifically, looking at all the data, all the blue books, like the ones that Marx was studying when he was preparing Capital, looking at the blue books, trying to understand it systematically and trying to formulate socialism out of there. And no one knows who the hell these people are. No one knows it in the socialist movement globally. No one knows them in the U.S. And they tried to develop scientific socialism fucking 20 years before Marx and Engels. Why aren't we looking back at those people with pride and showing to the American people, look, socialism, as you know, Cornel West says, is as American as apple pie.
Mm.
It's not antagonistic to your history. The best things you have in this country, the ones you appreciate the most, were won by socialists and by socialist struggles. The only president that you elected four times, FDR, his vice president, William Wallace, had previously ran with the Socialist Party. He had the backing of the communists. He was friendly with the communists. He was friendly with the Soviet Union. And he implemented many social measures that were promoted by the communist labor movement and by the Communist Party and the Socialist Party. Why is it that the president that the American people to this day love the most was the one that was the most friendly to socialism? Why is that? You know, so it requires rethinking our history dialectically and understanding that there's two poles. There's the pole of capital and there's the pole of the people's struggles. And we have to get the aspect that is not principle right now, but can become principle, which is the aspect, the opposite, the antipole of the people's struggle. We have to use that in our struggle today, and we're not doing it. So those are the three ways I see the purity fetish manifesting itself. And again, the fetish is grounded on where the hell it is that these people who are dominating socialist organizations are coming from.
Well, yes, and there's been a very deliberate annihilation of the working class's history, the working class's knowledge of itself as a class. Mm-hmm. And that's true in this country. I think it's probably even more true in the United States, because the labor movement has been diminished even further than ours has been. But if we're ever going to actually get back to a place where the class even has the confidence to struggle en masse for basic class demands, then that history needs to be brought back. I mean, to use the term from Gramsci, it's like we need a new layer of organic intellectuals again, right, to start emerging in the working class. I mean, the ruling class know that layer is important. That's why their objective here in the 80s was to extirpate that layer completely and make sure it didn't come back again, which is why now, of course, you have a socialist movement dominated by tenured professors telling you they're going to decolonize the curriculum, you know? And it looks ridiculous to most workers, because it is. It's like, yeah, you're going to decolonize something when you're on, you know, £80,000 a year, £100,000 a year. I don't think so. But it suits the ruling class very well to have socialism like that. The one thing that they desperately do not want to reemerge again is this, the layer of organic intellectuals that kept socialism within working class communities alive in Britain up to probably the late 80s. They never want that to come back again. But to get that back again requires organization. It's not going to emerge spontaneously. It has to be a coherent political project, which some of us are trying to build, but we're in a minority at the moment. But
it's a growing minority. It's a growing minority within most organizations. It's a growing minority, and we're really trying our best to keep it growing at the Institute. We have friends who, one of the people who I grew up with in terms of my development as a Marxist-Leninist, he had the opportunity to go the route of going to graduate school, getting his PhD. He had a full scholarship to University College Dublin. And he said, no, I'm going to rail, because that's what the working class, the socialist movement needs from me. Mm. And he's in an area where most of his coworkers are Trump supporters. They know this guy's a real communist, not the sort of communist here that condemn every socialist project. He embraces every socialist project, even at the moments where people are most iffy. But he's a communist, and his co-workers know he's a communist, and they've been pushing him, basically begging him to run for leadership in his union in rail, which is, it's currently about to go on strike in the US. Mm. Why is that? It's because he's an organic intellectual. He doesn't treat them as in a condescending manner. He doesn't make them feel like when he's hanging out with them, like it's an HR meeting. He actually helps. You know, he reads all the contracts. He lets his coworkers know what they can do, how they're getting shafted, all these other things. And he's just a regular good human being, like what every single communist should be. You know, we should lead by example. We can't call ourselves the vanguard and then get pissed off by the smallest things and just refrain from doing. You know, we need to develop a genuine communist ethic. You know, some of the leading communist thinkers, Gramsci, he saw the project as an ethical political project. You know, that doesn't mean, you know, this liberal moralism of, you know, if you want to combat climate change, just recycle. No, it means It means thinking about human beings dialectically, as each human being is not this separate thing. It's not a Robinson Crusoe-like individual. It's an ensemble of relations that expresses itself through the uniquely singular. It's both individual and collective. And when you think about that, then an ethical transformation is also a political one. And so this ethical political transformation, which is embodied in the work of Gramsci, it's embodied in the work of Che, it's very important. If communists want to lead, they need to also learn how to lead by example. They need to try to make themselves as superb human beings as possible. And that's also another part that's completely absent from the modern left in the US. It's a very defeatist culture. If you call someone by the wrong pronouns or something, they're just falling apart. And, you know, not anything against, you know, the people in that, but you can't have that. You need to have a tough skin. Like, just imagine some of the leading communist figures who have led guerrilla struggles. If they were just like very weak-minded and just let anything get to them, they wouldn't have done what they did. Communists need fortitude, and they need to develop, you know, what they're calling in China a virtue ethic, a communist virtue ethic. And this is another part of the project that we have tried to. This is another aspect of what we think is missing that we have tried to emphasize through our institute.
Mm. Well, I think that's a good place to actually wrap this up, Carlos. Which is, do you want to talk a little bit more about your institute, about Midwestern Marx, and where people can find you online and find out more about what you do and things like that?
Sure thing. Our institute is really taking an approach to socialist education and organizing that is trying to cast the net as wide as possible. So we have anything from a TikTok, which I was skeptical of when Eddie started it, because I thought it was a sort of a younger people dancing app. But he started posting there 1 and 2 minute videos on politics and Marxist theory, and it blew up. You know, we ended up getting up to 400,000 followers, and then getting censored because of, speaking truth to power now with this proxy war against Russia. And that development fed our website, which publishes articles on Marxist theory and history and politics, political analysis from a Marxist perspective. We have an academic journal, not academic in the sense that it's out of the academy, but a scholarly journal called the Journal of American Socialist Studies, where we try to recapture in an interdisciplinary manner this positive history of socialism in the U.S. And we have, of course, our YouTube, where we do interviews, videos, all sorts of stuff. And we have our social media platforms that you can find us in. It's just Midwestern Marx, except for Twitter, which is Marx Midwest. We have, as of recently, our publishing press, the Midwestern Marx publishing press, which we have two books out now, three books out now, Reading the Classical Texts of Marxism from Dr. Thomas Riggins. He's a chief editorial counselor in our project, a 60-year-long communist militant and retired philosophy professor who has been very influential for our project. We also just released one of his books on Eurocommunism that explores not just the theoretical revisionism behind Eurocommunism, but the failures and then how they've been incorporated, even in the parties that formally reject Eurocommunism. And then we've also published my book, which of course has that introduction, which I tried to do something that I never found when I was doing my studies on dialectics and the dialectic materialist outlook, which is try to connect all the parts together. Because you see Engels talk here about dialectical laws, and then in this other place he's talking about categories, and then another place Marx is talking about the ascension from the abstract to the concrete, calling it the dialectical method. And you're like, well, what's the relationship of all of these different parts? So what I try to do in that introduction is bring all the parts together in a way that that makes it a coherent worldview. And I then add some of, I think, the best literature on Marxist theorists who have been explicitly thinking about the dialectic materialist method and worldview, which includes people that are known like Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, Mao, people that are a little bit less well known, but who were influential in the development of Lenin, like Bukharin and Plekhanov, and then people like Moshe Olgin, who was a Ukrainian Jewish Marxist who came to the U.S. I think in 1915, and was one of the key theorists eventually for the Communist Party. And people like J.D. Bernal, J.B.S. Haldane, great scientists who were Marxists. And then I finished with Evald Ilyenkov, who I think embodies some of the best things in the Marxist-Leninist tradition, which is its ability to be creative in the sense of consistently bringing forth the study of the concrete concretely. Mm. So that's the book. And we have many other books in the works. Where we have an exciting volume for next year called Against the Fake Left, a Marxist critique of contemporary academic radicalisms, where we take some of the leading Marxist thinkers who critique all of these forms of pseudo Marxism, and we compend it all in one volume. We have we already have like half of it prepared. A lot of the people on there are very exciting, like Gabriel Rockhill, Jennifer Ponce de Leon, Vivek Schuber, who we talked to yesterday. Quite a few people, and it's going to be a very exciting volume being released sometime next year. But that's what we're up to. It's I think a project that hasn't been something like it in the U.S. in a while, and I think that in part the bit of success that we've had, I think, just confirms our thesis, which is that people want these ideas, that if you approach them with them, they will accept them because the conditions are ripe for a revolutionary situation.
Well, we know that that's the case, because even Putin is quoting Lenin approvingly now. So it must be, things must be changing.
Right. Let's hope the CPRF over there can continue to exert its influence. And I mean, it's insane to me how people in the U.S. who were delusional enough to think that you can push Biden left somehow don't think that Putin, one, plays a historically progressive role, and two, can be positively influenced by the massive upsurge of the CPRF over there. So,
yeah, only Democrats can be moved left. That's the new rule, apparently.
Right.
All right. Well, Carlos Garrido, thank you for your time today. It's been a very interesting discussion. I'm sure the listeners will get a lot out of this. And be sure to check out the book, Marxism and the Dialectical Materialist Worldview. It's a very valuable educational tool. So, Carlos, thank you.
Thank you, brother. It was a pleasure to be on. Great talking to you.